Thank you, Mark. Yeah, it's such a blessing to be here. I love Lincoln. I gave a talk with Patrick Callahan at UNL last year and enjoyed that. And let's see, it's my fourth time here. I came here, I was in college in 2000. And we did the Focus Fellowship of Catholic University Conference back then here and really enjoyed it. So it's great to be here. Like Mark said, I wrote a book on this recently. So any excuse I get to talk about it, very happy to. I find that this topic is one that for my young people at the college, they struggle with the most. And they end up feeling like they had to either choose between reason or faith. And I chose to focus on Pope Benedict. Also, John Paul talks about this a lot and how the two of those really go in harmony with one another. So I want to just share some highlights of some ways to understand the harmony of faith and science. There are always, with things like this, there's multiple different takes you can have on it. I love this image from G.K. Chesterton. He says that the church is like a big playground, but it has high walls. The high walls that secure the playground are the dogmas of the church that can't change. But then sometimes within there, there's a lot of room for play. And some of the more really, really complicated things like original sin and whatnot, I'm not going to be going into so much for the main presentation. But I want to begin by just showing you sort of what the Catholic Church doesn't hold. Okay, so at Ave Maria, Mark, I drove by this church on Vanderbilt Beach Boulevard one day, and this was the sign. I didn't take a picture, but I went to Google and found the same thing. And it said, faith is the, either way you want to put it, reason is the worst enemy that faith has. So that is a view that a lot of our Protestant brethren have, not all of them. And the church called that fideism, from the Latin fides. It's faithism, where faith and reason are opposed. And when they seem to be opposed, you choose faith. Of course, the opposite of that is rationalism, or what John Paul II calls scientism. When anytime there's an apparent conflict, science wins. And so every time you have that, the Bible is wrong, say. The church saves us from those opposite opposing errors. And in fact, J.P. II wrote a whole encyclical, some of you might remember, Fides et Ratio, faith and reason. One of the most memorable lines in there is when J.P. II says that faith and reason are like two wings on which the human spirit soars toward the contemplation of truth. Such a beautiful image that he has. And so we want to walk through each of those real quick, faith and reason. I think intuitively we all know what reason is, but basically what is it? It's the truth we know by natural means. And you see here Plato and Aristotle pictured from Raffaello. It's the ability to know God through things like philosophy, science, whatever field you're in that reveals something about God. That's reason. And the university was founded in the Middle Ages by Catholics to show that all truth is versus, directed towards uni, towards one truth, which is God. Faith is rational, but it's also supra-rational. It's above it. It's not against it. It's not a blind leap, but it transcends reason. And we know things through faith that we can't know through reason. So think about something that no human ever argued themselves to, the Trinity, right? That Jesus is the incarnate Son of God, things like this. So how do these two work together to help us know God? As grace builds upon nature, so faith builds upon natural reason. So you have to have a firm foundation to understand the good world that God made, and your faith then elevates that. But it's certainly a shame, at least for evangelization, if we were to know the faith but not know the natural world at all. In the medieval period, Hugh of St. Victor said that God wrote two books, the Bible and creation. So the Bible takes that natural knowledge of creation and builds upon it. But of course, sometimes the truth seems to contradict, right? So a favorite line of mine from JP2 is, truth cannot contradict truth. If you know something through reason, and this is to quote Aquinas for a minute, then you've misunderstood the faith if it seems to contradict the reason. I'll give a few examples of that here in a bit. But properly understood, they can't contradict, because to give another line from my favorite medieval saint, Aquinas, All truth, no matter its source, is of the Holy Spirit. Just so great to be Catholic, guys. Why do I spend time relying on my wife to watch our six kids and come off and doing this stuff? It's because I just love the church and her approach. So just think about the medieval period. St. Thomas Aquinas was looked upon pretty skeptically at first because he dared to bring in this pagan guy, Aristotle, to help him reflect upon the faith. And his master, Albert the Great, did the same. He learned it from him, and he was a scientist. And we've done that from time immemorial. You see this line, despoil the Egyptians? That was the church father's spiritual exegesis, their reading of the Israelites leaving Egypt. You should take what is good from the pagans and sort of baptize it and purify it when necessary. But take whatever is good in them and build upon that. So what does that mean for the relationship of faith and science? This line John Paul II wrote to the head of the Vatican Observatory. And yes, we have a Vatican Observatory, which is just tremendous. So what's the relationship? Science can purify religion from error and superstition. Religion can purify science from idolatry and false absolutes. They draw one another closer to the truth. So there are many examples of this scientism, but one that leaps to mind immediately is the late Stephen Hawking wrote a book where he said that the world spontaneously created itself. The universe popped into being spontaneously, according to the laws of science. And I remember reading Bishop Barron on this. He said he almost fell out of his chair laughing because he just said it spontaneously created itself according to the laws of science. Really, Hawking just admitted God, something pre-existed, the world. But so you have to call out that false absolute when science would say that it doesn't need God anymore. To give you one concrete model that I enjoy, it's St. Paul. You guys remember when he goes to Greece? I've stood on this site, or what's left of it, the Areopagus in Athens. And he's going by and looking at all the altars and temples, many of which are still there, some in crumbles. One that's not there anymore that Acts tells us about is one to an unknown God. So Paul points us out to his Athenian crowd and says, I've noticed, O Athenians, that in every way you are very religious. So he praises their piety, even if it's to false gods. And he starts quoting their poets. In him and In him we live and move and have our being. And we are his offspring. Pagan poets. So he praises the good in them. But then he says, the times of ignorance God has overlooked. He's coming to judge the living and the dead. He sent his son, Jesus Christ. So that model then is for us as well, for all times. We can take the good, praise the good. Even if it's an atheist, they may have something to say. But also we have to call them out, especially when they go beyond their own reach, when they don't stay in their lane, if you will. So here are a few examples that I just came up with. I've got a bunch more, but how the church has engaged this over the years. The church got a black eye with the Galileo case, and people love to wield the Galileo case against the church today. But in point of fact, the church has always been in favor of things like physics and astronomy. Galileo, yes, to be sure, we've sort of taken a better approach in more recent centuries. But Galileo here is going to be one of the early ones, like Copernicus, to move us away from a geocentric to a heliocentric universe, right? Where the Earth is not the center around which everything turns. There's a great letter he wrote, which really some ecclesial officials helped him write, which is called the Letter to the Grand Duchess Christina. And you see the quote up there. Scripture teaches us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. It's actually a really good way of summarizing a lot of church teaching, actually, that the proper object of scripture and revelation is not the sciences, but about God himself, man, and how we're supposed to live in the universe. Another example is the Big Bang. You know, when this first came out, people in the secular world were against it because it seemed to imply God. And one of the people who came up with it was the French priest Father Georges Lemaître. Now, my name is French and we butcher it, so I might as well butcher his and just say Father Georges Lemaître. So mine's supposed to be Ramage, but we say Ramage. Yeah, the Big Bang, the church has nothing against the Big Bang. The Big Bang, as one physicist I like says, it's like an icon of creation. Now, as long as you don't say that it doesn't need God, that's okay. Sexuality. This is a real hot topic these days. I don't want to bring us afield from the proper object of the talk. The church is pro-science, and so we're also in favor of understanding the complementarity of man and woman, right? And all the things associated with that that the church teaches. Another thing I could add, I'll talk about pro-life things in a bit too. Fossils geology. Blessed Nicholas Steno is a patron who really helped pioneer the study of geology and fossils. Amazing. I just learned that last year, actually. One of the organizations I belong to is I'm a scholar associate of the Society of Catholic Scientists. And one of the guys who helps run that really has done a lot of neat work on him. You see my daughter over here. This is at Dinosaur National Monument in Utah. Has anybody ever been there before? It's worth a look. Okay, we're a National Parks family. Used to be a Europe family until we had too many kids. You have the dinosaur bones are still in situ where they were. There's this whole wall of dinosaur bones. So, we love dinosaurs, and Catholics can love dinosaurs. Genetics and evolution. Gregor Mendel, the father of genetics, was an Augustinian. So it's just fascinating that while he's doing something that today's standards would consider rudimentary with the pea plants, he basically developed the field that is among the most important today in the sciences for understanding evolutionary theory. Now, with those examples in play, at the same time, here's what a secular guy, you guys have probably heard of Richard Dawkins before. It's like one of the people, if you turn on History Channel at Easter, try to debunk things sort of guy. And I have nothing personally against Richard Dawkins. He takes cheap shots at Christians. And he actually has some interesting stuff to say, but this is his mentality. Before Darwin came along, it was pretty difficult to be an atheist, at least one free of nagging doubts. Darwin came along and made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. He thinks Darwin implied atheism. And what's sad is a lot of Christians, including Catholics, buy into that. They buy into Dawkins' premise, or that's actually not the church's teaching. So the church is quite wise. The church is never going to say, thou must accept evolutionary theory because it's a scientific proposition. But here are some quotes I wanted to show you guys. John Paul famously called evolutionary theory more than a hypothesis. Benedict XVI speaks of the many proofs for it. The International Theological Commission of the Vatican speaks of it as being virtually certain and demonstrated through converging fields of evidence. But like I said, it's not an essential faith matter. I have friends who completely reject evolution. We're good friends, right? And that's a model we should follow. But also at the same time, we have to be able to have an answer for those who call us to account for the hope that's within us, like St. Peter says. And frankly, one of my favorite reasons to talk about this stuff is I find God revealed through the history of life. So just on the theory of evolution, guys, I have a colleague who says that in theology and philosophy, words are like numbers are in math. You mess one up, the whole thing gets screwed up. So the word theory in common parlance means an opinion, right? That's just your opinion or your conjecture. A scientific theory, and if some of you are scientists, you would certainly know this, is something that's well established, right? It's got many fields pointing towards it. It's the best explanation of facts. It's confirmed by experiment. It can predict. And yet, as you see in my little italics, for scientists, you don't prove a theory. You fail to falsify it. It's always open to revision. So when we think about the history of the timeline of life on Earth, that I won't spend too much time on that tonight, we could always tweak it here and there, or even have pretty significant tweaks about the history of Homo sapiens and when we arose. An example would be, more recently, the dating for humans has been around 200,000, 150,000 years ago. And that's when we start to see anatomically modern humans. But it's also possible, as some people are now arguing, I think with some merit, that we were rational already with Homo erectus 2 million years ago. Those sorts of things are always open to revision. one of the more important lines is that when you get into biology, not much makes sense except from the point of view of evolutionary theory. So I want to dedicate just a few minutes to what the priest biologist Father Nicanor Astriaco called the web of evidence for evolution. This is my opportunity, guys, to show pictures, have story time, and just share some of the things I love about the created world that really don't make sense apart from evolutionary theory. I have 50 times more of this stuff, but just wanted to show you some things. So the fossil record's the most common one. It's only one of about seven areas that point toward it. I have a megalodon tooth in my china cabinet. We collect fossils. It's about the size of my palm. And it's not that great whites evolved from megalodons. They share a common ancestor. But I just love this picture here. We have a great white tooth that's black, but it's about this size. And then there's the megalodon tooth. And you can see the relative size of these. Through the fossil record, we can trace and date the development of these species and their vanishing. Another one that's kind of fun from my point of view, I think they're illegal now, but I had a snakehead fish when I was a kid. My older siblings and in-laws were college kids when I was like in junior high, and they would buy these crazy animals. So you have a proto-lung structure in a snakehead. Other fish have these too, but if you go on YouTube, there's always cute cat videos you can watch. But if you Google snakehead videos in Florida, where I used to live, and they have enough of a proto-lung, they can crawl across land to get to the next pond. And so we can point towards avenues like that by which lungs developed. Gosh, there's a museum in central Kansas called the Sternberg. Mudskippers and other species like this. And then you look at things like whale evolution. So I've definitely heard people call whales fish, but they're definitely not fish, right? They're mammals. Whales used to live on land, and remarkably, you can trace their lineage. One of the more fun things I should have included a picture of, actually, I think I put it later, is whales still have pelvises or remnants of pelvises, things that point toward their history. And of course, you have humans, right? I was at the Smithsonian in DC this summer, and I love to go to these museums and see the actual fossils. And it's never going to be complete, but we can trace pretty well of the earlier humans, like the famous Lucy fossil of Australopithecus about 7 million years ago, through Homo erectus a couple million years ago, to the more modern humans, to where we are today. So that's the fossil record. And it's quite frankly remarkable we have the fossils we do. It's not easy to fossilize things. But also we looked at things like comparative anatomy, homologous structures, things that are similar in animals that bespeak our common ancestry. So the whale with its vestigial pelvis there. And if you look inside a whale flipper as opposed to say a fish fin, they have hands that are quite similar to ours because we share that common ancestry. Humans are really weird. We share common things like with chimps and bonobos and gorillas. Fun to go to a zoo and see these things. It doesn't mean they're the exact same, far from it. We diverged millions of years ago from the chimps, our closest ancestors. But you look at things also like vestigial organs, fossils in our bodies that make no sense apart from this science. You can always say God put them there to test us. But things like this little map has on it, the coccyx, the tailbone. Why is it called a tailbone? I'll talk about that in a second. Darwin's tubercle, Darwin's point on the ear. Can any of you guys wiggle your ears? I won't call on you, I promise. Yeah, my dad could do it. Dad's no longer with us here, but I didn't inherit the gene. But he had the gene, and that's directional hearing. But over time, we lost the ability for it because we didn't need it. But the tailbone, interesting, because some people, as you'll see in a minute, actually have the tails. There's the tubercle. And here you can see in the embryonic stage, we have a baby that's about 14 weeks old in the womb right now. I'll show you a picture in a minute. And we go through this phase where we look kind of like an alien. The pharyngeal arches are parallel to what you see in gill slits in fish, and you see the long ones here in the giraffe. So these are just comparative structures that you could say they evolved independently or they were directly created out of nothing independently. But they sure have the appearance of having evolved. I think my favorite one has to be the egg. So this is like a chicken egg yolk, obviously. But humans have vitellogenin, DNA or yolk-producing DNA in them, which makes no sense unless we used to have it once upon a time. Even more radical is atavism. This is when you have the fossilized DNA, but then through a quirk, it reappears and the structure exists once again in history. So I have a bunch of chickens and a bearded dragon and a cat and all these humans running around. Every once in a blue moon, you have a chicken with teeth. And my understanding of it is that they end up dying. But why would chicken have teeth? Well, it's because their ancestors had teeth. They were dinosaurs. The chicken seems to be the closest relative to T-Rex that's still alive, believe it or not. And they're evil. I mean, if you go, I don't really mean evil, but they're cruel. So I've had two chickens kill other chickens. Gosh, we could talk chicken stories with people afterwards, probably. They're very cruel. And if you have one run after you at eye level, it's a little bit scary. But they reactivate that gene for the teeth. And then you have humans sometimes are born with tails. One of my old professors is on a medical board, and just this past year, he had to deal with an ethics case of what to do. There's the question, again, if anybody's in medicine, you know it better than I do, of what do you do about that, right? So these things that reappear that are in our DNA from prior evolutionary stage, most of us, we just have a tail bone. Then you look at throughout the history of life, we see this in the fossil record, the transitional structures. So the evolution of the eye, you're never going to completely trace it. You can't have every last fossil, but it's remarkable how early eyes began as just sensitivity spots, and they began to focus until you eventually get a complex eye like in an octopus. So we can trace these things now. Wings, I love wings. Ostrich, obviously. I've never seen an ostrich, I think, outside of a zoo, but I understand they don't fly. But their wings are still useful for balance. And there are some species of birds that can run up a ramp more than 90 degrees. So you see that things that had a purpose early on get refined over time, or the species dies, and they get co-opted into new purposes like flying. There's a couple more areas. One is biogeography, plate tectonics. So we just brought the family to Yellowstone a month ago. I'm on sabbatical right now, so I was able to take a week and bring the family somewhere. And Yellowstone sits atop a massive supervolcano, which we would very much regret if it lit back up. Now, one of the things we also did was we went into Idaho and to, what's it called, Craters of the Moon National Monument. That place is stupendous. It's like walking on Mars or something. It's black. It's a lava field the size of Rhode Island. And as the Earth's crust moves, as the tectonic plates move, the hotspot stays the same. So you can actually see on the map at the national site of how there was explosion here X million years ago. A million years later, it hits here in Idaho. Currently, it's at Yellowstone. Well, you can trace that too to the continents like South America and Africa. The reason they look like they should fit like a puzzle is because they used to fit like a puzzle. And you see this appear with species. Now, there are some species that appear everywhere, like trilobites. I have a couple fun trilobite fossils. They're not quite a dime a dozen. They're more like $7 each. But they were the sea bugs of the world 405 million years ago. But other species you only see in certain places. So why do you only have kangaroos and certain species in Australia? It's because that certain species evolved after the continent split. And that's how you get speciation, how different species come to be in the first place. One of the aspects of that is they split off and no longer mate, and they change. Or like New World plants. Tomatoes, I believe, are a New World plant. I'd have to verify my own research on this. They're a common ancestor you can trace, but the specific structure gradually changed. Sometimes there are big changes. Benedict XVI even calls those leaps. One shift in a gene can cause a huge difference. But you see this in biogeography. I've never been here. I've been close in northern India. But if you go across the Himalayas to Nepal, you find ammonites, ancient sea creatures, in the Himalayas. What are they doing there? Because it used to be ocean and it got raised up. Or as I have on the right side here, that's not a real picture, obviously. But they have actually found dinosaur fossils at the North Pole, back when there was a land bridge crossing. And again, I can't resist, guys. I always add more slides, but I love sea salt. And why is there sea salt in the Himalayas? That picture there is of Alexander the Great. And when Alexander's army got to a certain point in India and stopped, the horses, I think the story goes, they were licking the salt, and they discovered, for themselves at least, discovered this Himalayan sea salt. There used to be an ocean there. I'm not sure about Nebraska, guys, where we are right here, but in Kansas, where I live, our particular location was in the Pennsylvanian era, roughly, give or take, 400 million years ago, a shallow sea, and you can find fossils that look like they belong on a beach today there. But if you move out to central Kansas, like Hayes, when it was a sea, then you find different things entirely. This picture is from the Petrified Forest out in Arizona. They had a Pangaea puzzle when you had one supercontinent. But this picture here is the Western Interior Seaway, which was how you get things like mosasaur fossils. I don't know if any of you guys saw that Jurassic World movie, not the original Jurassic Park, but Jurassic World. I won't spoil it, but it has a mosasaur, huge aquatic sea creature, very fearsome. And you can find mosasaur teeth out in central Kansas. I have a couple because of that shifting of the tectonic plates. All these things point towards our common ancestry with all creation. But actually, the most interesting and compelling one is only about 20 years old. We've known about direct observation. This is COVID. We don't want to think about COVID. But it evolves, and that's why the vaccines have to be redeveloped. Things like fruit flies evolve very quickly. It's tough to measure most of life on such a long time scale, but we have genetics, and this is the key. Check out these sentences, guys. The evolution of creatures and the evolution of language actually is a close parallel. I love the languages. My speaking abilities diminish over the years, but I do French, Italian, German, Spanish, Hebrew, Greek, Latin. And when you look at English's evolution, you can see how the letters change over time until you get to more modern. Well, how do you get, say, Italian, which is my best modern language, because I live there? Italian comes from Latin. We got the different dialects of Italian that emerged because they were separated by geography. And French separates off from Latin because of the separation in geography, and English separates off from its common ancestor with German, and then imports a bunch of French words, in other words, because of our separation in geography. Frankly, when I came down with my disease lupus 20 years ago, I was in Sicily for a month, and I'll tell you what, I couldn't understand a lick of Sicilian. I knew Italian pretty well, I thought, but just a couple hundred miles from language I could understand, it was a different species of language. So when you look at humans, we split from the chimps are our closest ancestor, and we split from gorillas and orangutans earlier. Now, you don't need to understand this whole chart, but what I want to show you with this, from a nice book, if you're into genetics and want to really take a deep dive, it's called Adam and the Genome by a couple good Christian scholars. One's a biologist, one is a theologian. And you see here that we have these common mutations with these other species. But then we split with the orangutans first, and you'll see we share less with them. And then they have some mutation that happened after we split. We share this with gorillas, but not orangutans. We share these two with chimps. And then mutations always happen later. This is for an olfactory gene, but you could do this with any number of genes in our genome. You can trace back into a genealogy or a family history, and even date approximately when we split from them. So what's interesting about that, like I mentioned, the ear moving genes, or we smell less excellently and we smell better, but we have the power of smell less profound than our cousins because we didn't need it anymore and it got degraded. Now, one of the weirder things about humans, guys, and there's a really good talk on this on the Thomistic Institute. It was titled something like, Did Christ Come to Die for Neanderthals? I think it was Father Simon Gain OP who gave it. So if you're a white person like me, really, if you're anything but sub-Saharan African, you have give or take 2-3% of your DNA from Neanderthals. And the reason is that we bred with them. So once we left Africa, people like me, bred with them. Now, if you're from Southeast Asia, Oceania, you're going to have another species, Denisovan DNA. You guys ever heard this one, I'm sure, like the claim that humans evolved from monkeys? Not at all. We split from monkeys millions and millions of years ago. It's that if you go back far enough, we share a common ancestor with chimps, gorillas, etc. But there's something very, very different about Homo sapiens, right? And what gets us upset about the secular world is when it starts saying that we're just one branch, right? There's nothing different about us. Let's start talking about what's different about us now. I want to talk about how God providentially created the world and guided it throughout history. I'm drawing some principles from Thomas Aquinas and Pope Benedict, some other saints. And guys, the fundamental thing here is, I put in a few points, but God is glorified when he works through creatures. He can sidestep creatures and go directly and do something that's called a miracle. But think about the miracle of life. God could create, boom, write that and bring a child into the, like Jen and I, my wife, could have an intimate moment of knowledge, gazing each other's eyes, and out comes a kid, boom. Maybe some of you ladies would prefer that, right? I've had stuff come out of places I don't want to, and I understand. When you have kidney transplants and heart transplants, all that stuff, yeah. So, but he gives us the dignity of being causes, of really doing it too. So you don't create the soul of the new human, but you really do give the life. There's something God uniquely does, but you contributed to it. I think parental analogies and spousal analogies are usually among the best. So I don't know, just think about if you have young kids or used to have young kids, I want some audience participation now. What's something the kids hated doing for chores? Anybody? Dog poo, oh man. Yeah, so I don't know how I'm gonna spin this, okay? But there's just no glorified way to do dog poop. But presumably when you first started the dog poo thing, you could have done it more efficiently yourself. Right? Like, why am I wasting my time with these annoying kids? For me, the example that pops to my mind is the dishwasher jobs. Now, you could do it yourself and do better, but it gives the kid dignity, the dignity of work, as John Paul would say, to do the dog cleaning. I'm not sure he'll ever enjoy it, but certainly when you care for that animal through thick and thin, something develops in you, a virtue and a love for the animal that grows. Right. I'll use my chickens as an example. My kids and I probably split the labor half and half. But when they go out and get an egg, you know, I like to get the crazy ones like green and blue eggs. They have the joy of they help produce that. Right. But frankly, I'd be quicker at it myself. Or I have a lot of fruit trees and my 4-year-old currently likes to pick all the figs off the Chicago Hardy fig tree, which is kind of a precious tree around here. Right. But she has such joy that comes from participating as a true cause, even though I'd be better. So how does that connect here? God and creatures act on different levels. God gives us being, he gives us the powers, and then he allows us the dignity of doing things ourselves generally. Check out a few lines here. This is from Ratzinger, Pope Benedict. God works in the universe not next to, but through natural processes like conception and birth. St. John Henry Newman, this is the time when Darwin was brand new. They were contemporaries. Frankly, I probably wouldn't have been as enthusiastic as he was at the time. But he says that God's plan to create life through millions and really billions of years is a larger idea of divine prescience, foreknowledge, and skill. That he had this pedagogical plan from all eternity. And then Aquinas says, like, so God's wise, God's powerful. It's actually a greater perfection for a thing, not only to be good, but to be a cause of goodness in others and allow it to cause goodness. Here's my daughter, Michaela, in Utah. walking in dinosaur footprints. You can ask, well, why did God allow dinosaurs? What's the point of that? No single answer, but I think the real answer, my wife says, is because they're awesome. But the dinosaurs in their own way contributed. Again, birds survive. That's their only lineage that's here still. But they participated in the history of life that led up to us, and we would not have survived if they still were around, right? And so on and so forth. Here's a beautiful image. I have to credit my theologian wife for this one. We like Dante. We taught in Florence for my college, Benedictine College. Dante ends his great poem with speaking of the love that moves the sun and the other stars. You have Dante here gazing out upon the communion of saints. Well, does the love move the stars? Or does gravity do it? Both is the answer. The discovery of gravity didn't disprove Dante here. It's God's love works through the nature he made. Fetal development. This is so beautiful to ponder, especially when you have a new life growing in your household. So we can walk through the stages. You know, the heartbeat, super early. You can, what is it, day 22 or something like that. It's amazing how early you can see these things. But we begin looking like we are one fertilized cell, and then you look like an alien for a while, right? You start looking like a baby, right? Maybe a chicken. But that's a full human being right there. And we're never going to have a complete understanding of embryology, but we can trace it pretty well. Beautiful baby sucking her thumb. Now, here's a real picture from last week. I'm proud of this, guys. This is our 13-week-old baby. Did you see the nose? You can even see the lips, five fingers. We think at one point he or she was sucking their thumb. And then, of course, eventually, if all goes well, out comes the baby. Now, is it then pious to say, that you could quote Psalm 139, which is a beautiful psalm, God knit me together in my mother's womb. Does the embryology defeat that scripture verse? Does it falsify it? No, God really did knit you together in your mother's womb through his good creation he made. And as my wife likes to say, materially, this baby is what I ate. Right? So whether it's Indian food or whether, right? Ladies, it depends on the pregnancy, what you like. Jen, I think, is into Indian food right now. Fair enough. The first pregnancy, I had no interest in Indian food. After months and months of begging me, I finally went. I loved it. And she went off of it and couldn't stand it. I'm pretty sure I'm not the one that suffered the most out of that. But anyway. So just an example of how God and creatures work together. Same thing with the scriptures. God didn't dictate the scriptures. That's the way the Quran is said to be written, that Muhammad was illiterate. But as the Second Vatican Council teaches, God really did make use of the full powers of the human authors. They're geniuses. They're inspired. The words come from God, but also through their own artistic genius. So Aquinas gives two major rules for interpreting scriptures. And of course, I'll tie this to our topic. The first one he says is that you must hold to the truth of scripture without wavering. The scriptures are true, period. Secondly, you have to ask what it's teaching and be ready to abandon your particular inspiration, your particular interpretation, if it's proven false, lest scripture be exposed to the ridicule of unbelievers and obstacles placed to their belief. There's this line from Augustine that he refers to, and actually Galileo does too. It's in green. How can outsiders believe our books when they catch a Christian committing an error about something they know very well? In today's world, again, teaching thousands of kids over the years, what I have found is that this issue of evolution is a pretty common obstacle. Somewhere along the lines, they've been challenged and thought that that went against the faith. I've actually had people tell me after my class where it comes up as one among many things, that, oh, thanks, Dr. Ramage. I thought I couldn't accept the Catholic faith anymore, because they've learned something in science. So Bishop Barron points this out too, and the statistics prove it, that one of the major causes for people leaving the faith is the perceived incompatibility of faith and reason. And this would be the paramount one. So to understand what Genesis is doing, I'm going to summarize three keys for interpreting these passages which basically go back to the catechism. So the key to understanding a challenging Bible text is, first of all, to understand its historical context. I think I speak for myself too. We Americans, we tend not to pay attention to the outside world as much because America's great. And, you know, what do we need them for? But it really does have value to look outside and figure out the person's culture, where they're coming from. So the Bible is an ancient Near Eastern document. Abraham comes from Ur of the Chaldeans in Mesopotamia, modern day Iraq. He travels the Holy Land, modern day Israel. And so you see things like the document Gilgamesh. I've seen these manuscripts, these stone documents, my own eyes in London and Paris and elsewhere. And we know these stories of creation that predated the Bible. One of the things I'll talk about is that the Bible is in part a response to those stories. It's an answer to the problems in them. Here's a quote from Pope Benedict. Yes, I wrote the book. I love talking about my book. But if you want a simple introduction to some of this, Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger at the time gave four little homilies. They're published in a book called In the Beginning, Catholic Understanding of the Creation and Fall. And here's one of his lines. The genre, the literary style of Genesis expresses creation symbolically. They represent truth in the way that symbols do, like a Gothic window. I love Gothic cathedrals. My wife and I started dating in France. This is the chapel that, at least for a long time, held the crown of thorns, Sainte-Chapelle in Paris. Now, a Gothic cathedral or an icon, I'm a big icon fan, they're not meant to be video camera in the sense of a literal picture of what happened. They're actually deeper than that by not being a photo or a video. So Pope Benedict speaks of the literal sense, and the catechism does too, but it's like that line I mentioned a while back, words in theology like numbers and math. When people hear the word literal today, they think video camera. Probably better to think of the word literal as literary sense. So go to Jesus. If your right eye causes you to sin, what do? Pluck it out. Did he mean actually pluck it out? No, the literal sense is that it's a hyperbole for stopping your sin right now, right? But then other genres, when he talks about the Eucharist, he actually uses the word to gnaw in John 6. He really means it's his body and blood. Not biological change, but it's the substance of his body and blood. And so you have to understand that each book and even parts of books have their own genre. The first 11 chapters of Genesis have this figurative way of presenting, the symbolic mode. And to not grasp that, as one of my favorite evangelical authors puts it, is actually illiteracy. So to understand the nuance and genius of these authors. So here are some quotes. To give you one more word, if we said the Bible is myth, we'd probably first think, man, that's heretical, right? If you said Jesus is myth, that's heretical. But the early chapters of Genesis have a deep commonality with other ancient myths. What does it mean? I wanted to give you a couple Pope quotes to show this is not just making it up, Dr. Ramage. The catechism is probably the best, honestly. It's just the early chapters of Genesis present real events in the figurative language. So there really was a creation of the world. There really were humans that started, they sinned, all these things. Where there's latitude is what's historical, what's the point being made? John Paul describes the myth of the early chapters of Genesis as an archaic way of expressing deeper content than you'd have through something like a video camera. GKC, anybody have a guess who that is? Chesterton, yeah. He's probably the best on myth in his Everlasting Man book. He says that myth is an attempt to reach the divine through the imagination. Not false, it can have falsehood in it, like the Greek gods at war against each other, but it's fundamentally good. C.S. Lewis, myth is a real but unfocused gleam of divine truth falling on the human imagination. And he speaks of the Jewish people as the chosen people, right? And their mythology being the chosen mythology, the earliest vehicle used to convey sacred truths about God. Finally, not to be outdone, Pope Benedict says, oh yeah? So it has this mythical, figurative, symbolic stuff, but Genesis is also an anti-myth. And we really don't understand what it's up to unless we grasp the anti-myth. Like I said, Abraham came from Babylonia. The Jews were deported into Babylonia, right? That was the bottom, the nadir of their experience in 586 BC, when the king is killed after his, no, the king's eyes are poked out, right? After his sons are killed in front of him, and they're carted off to Babylon. They had to figure out, who are we? What is our point of existence? Are we still God's people? So the Genesis is an ancient document, but when it's finalized after the exile, it's a polemic against the false gods of Babylon, but also it's a positive statement of who is God, who are we, and what does he want to do with us? It reminds me of Fiddler on the Roof, you guys. Rev Tevye is speaking of the laws of Israel, and he says we have all these laws, and I'll butcher it, but he says to tell us who we are and what God wants us to do. So with that in place, I want to give us a principle from the Catechism, which is called Divine Pedagogy. It's taking it from the Church Fathers. You can read the line for yourself. Any teachers in the crowd? One, okay. So a pedagogy, as we know, is a teaching method. It comes from the Greek ago, to lead, and pais, a child. St. Gregory the Great says that the Old Testament documents the childhood of the human race. And God gradually leads us to the fullness of truth in Christ. But he does so, as Aquinas would say, little by little. Think about math. Right now, I'm trying to get my fifth grader to understand decimals, which we're like, you should know this already. And you go over it 20 times, right? And then 20 more times. And then he might get it and he forgets it. You keep going. That's the way the Old Testament was. God didn't reveal the Trinity all at once. Think about this. What would they have made the Trinity? Three gods, right? So he gives them as much as they can handle at one moment, much like you don't teach a second grader calculus. Pope Benedict says that the Old Testament is God's struggle to make himself known to the people, and the people struggle to grasp hold of God. It's an advance towards Christ. And here's your key for the divine pedagogy, guys. No passage of the Old Testament can be fully understood apart from its goal, its telos of reaching Jesus Christ. He is the key and the light who sheds the interpretation on everything else. So in light of Christ, when we see an Old Testament passage that seems to contradict science, say, the Second Vatican Council says you have to distinguish between two things. What's being taught? What's the essential point? What's the message? Pope Benedict uses the word kernel. Therefore, you see some, I think I chose peanuts up there. What's the real meat of it? As distinct from the shell, the literary vehicle. It's great. As a kid, I used to eat peanut shells. Maybe that's how I got lupus. I don't. But I worked in one of those restaurants where you threw the peanuts on the ground, right? But really, the shell is important, but it's not what you're trying to get to. So the Genesis depicts creation across 7 days, right? It has man being made from dust, and all these things are the vehicle for it. So let me simplify this a bit. You can ignore the fancy theological language. Look at these two points. Creation, faith, teaches us who God is, why God made things. What are they in their essence? How should we live? But John Paul II would say, the sciences ask different questions. They're complementary. When, where, how did things get created? How did they evolve? That's science. So John Paul speaks of the mutual autonomy, but interrelation of faith and science. They each are important. All right, without further ado then, I want to spend my last segment of this talk applying this to some concrete Bible stories. We could do so many, guys, but I've chosen just a small handful for this. So let's begin with the beginning. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. I'm happy to have updated this slide this week with a picture from the James Webb Space Telescope. This is not the creation of the world, but it's a beautiful example of just how glorious and ethereal space is. But that's not what the Bible is doing. It's not teaching how the world arose, whether it's eternal or not. It's teaching, as Pope Benedict says, one God made it through his logos, through his word, also through his love. What's theomachy? The Babylonians believed the world came to be through a war between gods. And actually, the god Marduk, who was their high god, he slays the goddess Tiamat, the sea monster, and separates the waters above and below and frames the world out of it. Humans, for the Babylonians, guys, are the blood of her slain consort, Kingu. So we're kind of divine, but also gross. Yeah. The stars were gods for these guys, too. Just like the Greeks, just like the Romans, just like the Norse. And we still see a remnant of that in our days of the week, right? But Genesis says, no, there's one God, and there's no struggle. He speaks it into being. For us today, it's so obvious, we take it for granted, but that was truly revelatory for those people. How about 7 days? The church fathers like Augustine knew that wasn't 7 24-hour days. It's actually a liturgical text, guys. It's so cool. So think about this. You have light before there is a sun. That should be a first clue. It's not a 24-hour Earth day. The whole point of it is God creates spaces, then he subsequently fills them, and it all is ordered towards Sabbath, the rest day. The point is that as God created and rested on the Sabbath, we as the image of God are supposed to do the same. As Pope Benedict says in his good book, Spirit of the Liturgy, that the whole point of creation is the worship of God. How about Adam? From the dust of the earth, that's the title of my recent book. No plant of the field had yet sprung, okay? That's Genesis 2. If you were to read Genesis 1, 26 to 28, just several verses before, remember in that account, we hear at the Easter Vigil, everything is created and man is last, really woman is last. But in Genesis 2, man comes first. That's a clear signal by the genius Jewish people, our ancestors in the faith, that it's doing something different than chronology. What does dust signify, if the catechism is right, that it's figurative? A couple things, guys. One is dust, as we know from Ash Wednesday, refers to our mortality. Aquinas says that our nature is mortality and God can give us the grace to not die. That's part of the dust. The other part is that we're intimately connected to all that is. We're not inserted from above. We are one with all the earth. We share the same genetic code. But as I'm working on right now during my sabbatical, and Genesis says after the flood, we have a covenant with all of creation. They really are our brethren. But also man has the spirit of God, the Ruach. We have a unique dignity that no other creature has. Eve, the rib. Is this meant to be a video camera? I remember thinking a while back, I don't think it's a dumb question. I think these are good questions. But I was like, do women have fewer ribs than men? And the answer, I don't think so. But the rib conveys something really interesting for the Jews. If you look at other myths, you'll have the woman or the lower classes created out of the foot of a god. And the point of that is to say, you are meant to serve us and we're meant to walk on you, right? Eve is created from the side. You can also translate it. They're equal. Also, right after that verse, it says, for this reason, the man shall leave his father and mother, the two shall become one, right? So it's teaching us marriage as well. Implicit for us, maybe 21st century readers, but for a Jew of any time, in antiquity, it's a way of saying man and woman come from the same origin and we're fulfilled by coming back and joining one another in one flesh union that only can occur between a man and a woman. It's divinely instituted. So with those examples in place, just think back to this line from John Paul. Science can purify religion from error and superstition. Religion can purify science from idolatry and false absolutes. I hope that a few of those examples I gave and the principles I gave will help you guys to navigate those. Yeah, I'd love you to read my book, but really the church's principles, they're in the catechism. They're in the Second Vatican Council. You pick up a book by Pope Benedict. We're so blessed to have the church that really you can find this nowhere else. So in parting, there's a couple of quotes. Thomas Aquinas says, error concerning creatures leads to false opinion about God. Jerome had said that ignorance of scripture is ignorance of Christ. Ignorance of the created world is also ignorance about God. But by his grace, we have so much access. And finally, a quote from Ratzinger, we can win the future only if we do not lose creation. If we don't remember that God is the source of all of this, who didn't just wind it up, he is intimately present in our lives right now as he was back then. G.K. Chesterton said, we tend to get enamored at all the fancy things, you know, all the miracles, which are great. But we should also be dumbfounded by the very muddiness of mud, the steeliness of still, the fieriness of fire. It's really in these ordinary, humble things that he also reveals himself to us. I hope this ordinary evening event helped you to do that just a little bit as well. I'll put up a few resources here to consider, and I'm happy to take questions for as long as Mark allows me. Thank you.